Chapter 20. Cult. The script we developed over the course of late July was spare and economical. It included the tape, naming Gutierrez with her cooperation, as well as McGowan's on-camera, on-the-record interview, and Nestor's interview with her face in shadow, accompanied by images of her messages from Irwin Reiter, documenting how Weinstein's behavior was seen as a serial problem within the company. The evidence we'd uncovered of the two settlements in London was included, based on multiple first-hand accounts of the negotiations and the check from Bob Weinstein's account. And there were sound bites from the four former employees who had gone on camera. McHugh, in the same period, had stumbled into a subplot. At a hockey game, he played a lot and periodically limped into the office with arcane injuries sustained on the ice, he'd run into a friend in the film industry who had tipped him off that there was mounting scrutiny of Weinstein's role on the board of AMFAR, the Foundation for AIDS Research. Fellow board members suspected Weinstein had misused funds destined for the charity. Weinstein was trying to get them to sign non-disclosure agreements. "Feels like second beat," McHugh texted, "but maybe worth being aggressive?" "I'd pursue quietly," I replied. "Don't want to trigger anything that could adversely impact this first story." After McHugh sent me his notes on the script, he wrote, "Time to get a real convo going between you, legal, Rich, and me and see the real tenor of this news org." "Yep," I replied. "We make an oddly good combo," he added. "Not because we work well, but because it's frustrating, I'm sure, to someone who's trying to find dirt or disparage us individually." Neither of us knew that McHugh's name, the names even of our crew members, were by then all over dossiers, quietly making their way around the world. We both had the sense, as we finished the story, that attacks were coming. We just didn't know what form they'd take. "He has a lot to lose, back up against corner," McHugh pointed out. "It'll be war." The last week of July, Susan Wiener, the general counsel of NBC News, sat with Rich Greenberg, McHugh, and me in Greenberg's office and paged through the script and elements list. I'd worked with Wiener before on investigations deemed particularly troublesome or likely to generate litigation. I'd found her to be a good lawyer with sound instincts. And she'd been supportive of the reporting, even when I'd picked subjects like a litigious Korean doomsday cult. Before her 20-plus years at NBC, Wiener had been deputy general counsel at the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority. She was thin and pale, with a shock of frizzy hair. In the office that day, she peered over her glasses and pursed her lips. "You've got a lot," Wiener said. "Can you play her the tape?" said Greenberg, with undisguised excitement. He'd already read and liked the script. In a meeting with him earlier that day, McHugh had prevailed in arguing for a longer-than-standard script, with an eye toward airing it on the web. Shorter Today Show and Nightly News versions could easily be slivered off. As the audio wound down, Wiener's tight expression dissolved into a half-smile. "Wow," she said. "And the source will meet you or whomever you want from legal to show you the contract with Weinstein's signature on it," I said. I asked her if she saw any outstanding legal issues based on her review of the material so far, and she said she didn't. "I think our next step is to seek comment," she said. McHugh shot me a relieved look. The news division's top lawyer and Greenberg, a veteran of its standards department, both wanted to proceed. Greenberg nodded at Wiener. "I want to let Noah know before we do," he said. Greenberg was still excited, barely suppressing a smile, as he, Wiener, McHugh, and I sat down with Oppenheim in his office later that day. Oppenheim flipped through his copy of the script, written story, and elements list. A groove deepened in his brow. "It's just a draft script," I said. "We'll get it tighter."
"Okay," he said flatly.
"We thought you should hear the audio," Greenberg said. He seemed to be caught off guard by Oppenheim's lack of enthusiasm. "It's pretty powerful."
Oppenheim nodded. He was still looking at the pages, not making eye contact.
Greenberg nodded at me. I hit play and held my phone out.
"No,"
Ambra Gutierrez said, her voice shot through with fear.
"I'm not comfortable."
"I'm used to that," Harvey Weinstein said again.
Oppenheim slouched deeper into the chair, like he was shrinking into himself. There was a yawning silence after the tape finished playing. Apparently realizing that we were waiting for him to say something, Oppenheim produced a sound somewhere between a weary sigh and an apathetic, "eh," and made a shrugging gesture.
"I mean,"
he said, drawing out the word, "I don't know what that proves."
"He admits to groping her," I said.
He's trying to get rid of her. People say a lot of things when they're trying to get rid of a girl like that. I stared at him. Greenberg and Wiener stared at him. Look, he said, annoyance creeping into his voice. I'm not saying it's not gross, but I'm still not sure it's news. We have a prominent person admitting to serious misconduct on tape, I said. We have multiple sourced accounts of 5 instances of misconduct, with 2 women willing to put their name out there. We have multiple former employees saying this was a pattern. We have his signature on a $1 million settlement contract. He waved a hand at me. I don't know if we can show contracts, he said. McHugh and I glanced at each other. We couldn't figure out why a news organization, which reported contractually protected information routinely in national security and business contexts, would suddenly be so concerned about upholding settlements related to sexual harassment. We're not relying solely on the contracts, obviously, I said. But patterns of settlements are newsworthy. Look at the Fox story. This isn't Fox, he said. I still don't think Harvey Weinstein's a name the Today Show audience knows. He looked at the pages again. And anyway, where would we even air it? This looks long. We've run 7-minute pieces on Today before. I can cut it down to that. Maybe Megan's show, but that's going away now, he said, seeming to ignore this. Megyn Kelly was concluding a brief stint anchoring a Sunday night news magazine program. We can put it on the web, McHugh suggested. I nodded, and the written version can go online too. Oppenheim turned to Greenberg. What are you proposing?
We'd like to reach out to Harvey Weinstein for comment, Greenberg said.
Oppenheim looked at Wiener. She nodded.
I think there's enough here to proceed with that call, she said.
Oppenheim looked at the pages in front of him. No, 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 he said. A nervous titter of laughter escaped him. We can't call Harvey. I've got to take this to Andy. He rose, pages in hand. The meeting was over.
Thank you. I think it'll make a big impact, whatever platform we put it on, I babbled as Oppenheim ushered me out.
McHugh shot me a stunned look. Neither of us could make sense of the reaction. The earlier months of the year had been dominated by the kind of targets Ostrovsky, the Ukrainian private investigator, was used to. 4 hours chasing a cheating spouse here, 6 tailing the wayward teenage son of a nervous mother there. In return, Haken, the bald Russian, would send over the agreed-upon $35 an hour, plus expenses. But as the summer unfolded, Haken was issuing assignments that felt different. These jobs gave Ostrovsky pause. They drove him back to that troublesome tendency to ask questions. Before dawn on July 27th, Ostrovsky headed to the next of those jobs. When he arrived at what looked to be a residential address, he found Haken's car, a silver Nissan Pathfinder. He and Haken agreed that they'd split up, Ostrovsky keeping an eye on the target's home, Haken standing ready to give chase to a work address. Haken hadn't said much about these new assignments. He'd just sent over a series of screenshots from some kind of dossier from a client. The screenshots featured addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, biographical information. They identified spouses and other family members. Ostrovsky's first thought was that they were following some kind of custody dispute, but that explanation fit less and less as the summer wore on. Ostrovsky flicked through the screenshots as he hunkered down to keep watch on the address. The formatting was identical to that of the documents that had made their way through the offices on Ropemaker Street in London, with blue italic Times New Roman headers and shaky English. As he looked at the details, a strange feeling came over him. He wasn't used to following reporters.
Chapter 21. Scandal.
On a muggy morning not long after the meeting with Oppenheim, I made my way through the sweating crowds, past the tilted cube at Astor Place, toward the East Village. I'd texted McGowan and she'd agreed to meet. At the Airbnb where she was staying, she emerged in pajamas, a half-moon silicone pad under each eye. She gestured to the absurd room around her, which was princess pink with fuzzy pillows everywhere.
I didn't decorate, she deadpanned.
She was drawn, nervous, even more stressed than when we'd last met. I told her we had stronger material than ever, but that her voice was going to be important. I wanted to take her up on her suggestion that we shoot more and her offer to name Weinstein to the NBC lawyers.
I don't trust NBC, she said.
They've been, I paused, careful, but I know they're good people and they'll do right by the story. She took a breath, seeming to steel herself.
Okay, she said. I'll do it.
She agreed to shoot a follow-up interview a few days later. She had to go replace Val Kilmer at Tampa Bay Comic Con first. "That'll be fun," I said as I stepped back out into the heat. "No, it won't," she replied. I was back at work in the cafeteria when my phone rang. It was Greenberg. "Great news," I said. "I spoke with Rose and..." "Can you talk?" he said. In his small office, Greenberg let me babble through my update on McGowan. "So, I know you've been asking for an update," he said. In the 2 days since the meeting with Oppenheim, I had stopped by Greenberg's office 3 times to ask if he had any word from Lack. Greenberg took a breath, as if bracing for something. "The story is now under review by NBC Universal." He wrapped his mouth around these last words strangely, like he was quoting a lyric in a foreign language. "Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto." "NBC Universal," I said, "not NBC News." "It's gone upstairs. I don't know whether that involves Steve Burke or Brian Roberts," he said, referring to the top executives at NBC Universal and its parent company, Comcast, "but it's under legal review." Greenberg was fidgeting, jiggling a knee under the desk. "Maybe once when we got close to air on a tough story, I saw a high-level corporate review, but this is very atypical." "What are they basing this review on?" No one had asked us for additional copies of the material or for the audio. "I don't know," he said absently. An NBC Universal legal review meant Kim Harris, the general counsel of NBC Universal, who had, with Wiener, presided over the pussy grab tape imbroglio the year before. Harris had also, years earlier, recruited me as a summer associate at Davis Polk. "I'd be happy to send the material to Kim," I suggested. "I can play her the tape." "My gosh, no," Greenberg said, mortified, like I'd proposed an orgy with his grandparents or something. "No, no, no. We'll respect the process and remain at arm's length. I'll make sure Susan sends them whatever they need." I wondered what logic we could have for keeping our own lawyers at arm's length, but said instead, "Well, I'd like to know as much as I can when I can, and I'll keep you updated on the follow-up interview with Rose." He flinched. "We're supposed to pause all reporting." "Rich, it's been hell keeping Rose hanging in there at all. Now we have more from her and you want me to go back to her and cancel?" "Not cancel," he said. "Pause. There is an actual interview date set. I would be canceling." I asked him how long we were supposed to pause. I would anticipate that it won't move fast," he said. "I mean, I have no idea what their process is, but this could take more than a few days." "Rich, I don't think anyone in our chain of command wants to be in the position, as a matter of record, of having canceled hard-fought pieces of reporting during a corporate review by our parent company. Things get canceled for all sorts of reasons. Nobody outside the company has to know why. If you tell them what you told me and Rich, it will matter for what happens to this story," I said, referring to his, "fuck it, let him sue," and his decision to go to Weinstein for comment. It was hard to square that guy with this guy. "This is a Steve Burke decision. It's an Andy decision," he replied. His eyes flicked away from mine. "What I say is not going to matter." I believed Rich Greenberg when he said he cared about journalism. I believed, absent friction, that he would have supported the reporting and pursued the interview with McGowan. But several colleagues of his said he shied away from messy confrontations. "He's really good as long as he's not in front of the pack," one veteran correspondent later told me. "He doesn't have the stomach for somebody's gonna be mad at you investigative reporting." Few stories got people madder than this one. That day in Greenberg's office, I remember thinking how small he seemed, not defeated so much as comfortable within the narrow bounds of what he could and could not do inside an organization to which he had devoted 17 years of his life. Exasperated, I told him, "Look, Ken Auletta just turned to the camera and said, 'Andy Lack, this is a scandal if you don't run this.'" Greenberg's eyes snapped up. "Do we have that? Is that in the script?" I looked at him, puzzled. "It's in the transcript." "Send that to me," he said. As I pushed out of the back doors of 30 Rock and into the summer heat, McHugh and I texted, debating what to do. There seemed to be no interest in the loftiest echelons of the corporation in hearing the tape or learning the full extent of the reporting. The only person who might have access to the corporate review that Greenberg hadn't discouraged us from reaching out to was Wiener, who, as the top lawyer in the news division, reported to Harris. I'd begun calling her the moment I emerged from the meeting with Greenberg. An assistant I reached told me not to stop by. After hours of calls, Wiener emailed to say she was busy, then leaving for a long weekend. Then there was the dilemma about what to do about the interview with McGowan. We are shooting with Rose. We are not canceling, McHugh texted. We both knew postponing could mean losing the interview entirely. On the other hand, refusing Greenberg's order to cancel the shoot might mean jeopardizing the increasingly tenuous support for the story within the network. With the legal department not taking our calls, I grappled with whom to turn to. Arriving back at my apartment, I decided to take a risk and call Tom Brokaw. Tom, I'm going to need to rely on that promise you made, I said, about not talking to the subject of that story we discussed. You have my word, said Brokaw. I told him about the corporate intercession. I ran him through the list of interviews and evidence. This is wrong, he said. He told me he'd reach out to the network's leadership about it. You need to talk to Andy. You need to go in and play that tape for him. I sent Greenberg the Auletta transcript, as he requested, with the comment about how it would be a scandal not to air the story highlighted. Then I forwarded it to Oppenheim. A few hours later, the phone rang. I got your email, said Oppenheim. So, he drew out this word like an emphatic teenager. I hope, based on our 2.5 year or whatever relationship, that you know you can trust me to do this process right. And this isn't about Andy doesn't want to do this or I don't want to do this. If we can establish that he's a predator, to use your term. To be clear, that's not coming from me. We have documents and sources from within his company making that claim. All right, he said. I hear you. If we could establish that he's whatever, of course we'd want to get it out. We just need to stress test this. And Kim, who I know you've known since you were like 16, is going to do that and tell us what we can really be bulletproof in saying, what can hold up in court. I told him that was all well and good, as long as the reporting wasn't being interrupted. I mentioned the interview we'd scheduled with McGowan. You just can't, Ronan, he replied. If Kim decides that tortious interference or inducement to breach contract are big concerns for us, we can't be rushing ahead with an interview before she makes that call. That's not how this works, I told him. We can get it in the can and then decide to review it later. Airing it is what makes it subject to litigation. I don't know, he said defensively. I'm not a lawyer. If they're saying tortious interference, I've got to listen. I am a lawyer, Noah. That's just not a real rationale. Half our political reporting wouldn't be possible if we refused to talk to sources who were breaching contracts. It was true. There were few solid cases that supported the idea that news organizations, acting in good faith, could be exposed to significant liability in cases like this. Well, forgive me if I take Kim Harris's legal advice over yours, he said tartly. I tried to think how to underline the stakes while conveying that I was a team player. My sense is this is gonna come out, I said, and the question is whether it comes out with or without us sitting on the evidence we have. A long silence. You'd better be careful, he said at last, because I know you're not threatening, but people could think you're threatening to go public. I knew what he meant, but the choice of words struck me as odd. Weren't we in the business of going public? But that's just it, I said. I think threatening us is exactly what Ken Auletta was doing. And I think that's why Rich asked me to send him that quote, and why I forwarded it to you. A lot of people know we have this. Well, he said, we're not sitting on it, we're reviewing it carefully. He softened a little, tried something different. Ronan, you know in my years of supporting you, we've run a series of stories that could get us sued, and we've stood by them. I trust you'll do the right thing, I said. There have just been some odd signals. We're just hitting pause while we wrap our arms around this, he said. That's all I'm asking. On some level, I knew these euphemisms, the pauses, the wrapping of arms, to be absurd. Canceling an interview was canceling an interview. The word double plus on good wandered through my mind. But I needed Oppenheim's support to get the story over the finish line. I looked out of the window. Across the street, the lights were off and the dance studio was in shadow. I'm glad you called, I said. I do trust you. Just hang tight, he said. No more reporting for a little bit. Chapter 22. Pathfinder. We were right to keep our mouths shut, McHugh texted. We decided we'd pushed Oppenheim as far as we could. I'd just sit back, work the phones and whatnot, but let the NBC team be. You've said your piece. But this still left the tricky proposition of the shoot with McGowan and the order to cancel it. Did Noah say don't do it? McHugh wrote. Yes. Quandary. It's tempting to just push it back and risk losing her, I replied. Just to avoid the fight with Noah. Think I can freely consult Greenberg on this? Not sure anymore, he wrote. We were starting to concede that we might have to take the risk of rescheduling with McGowan. I'm not sure another Rose interview is critical to our story, but NBC having our backs, in some ways, will be, McHugh wrote. I'm thinking maybe there's a way to push it to LA and buy ourselves a little more time? I took a deep breath and dialed McGowan. We were looking at maybe doing a later date, I said, feeling her out. We could shoot more with you in Los Angeles. Go back to your place. Her voice was small on the other end of the line. I'm not sure I can do this, she said. There's a lot coming at me. Just hang in there, I said. Please, for the other sources involved, I promise you it's just a little longer. I knew NBC wasn't going to take this seriously. They're taking it seriously. I'm taking it seriously. I offered to call the lawyers. They were going to do that. They're just reviewing things, I said. She didn't say anything. If Tuesday's all you can do, we'll do Tuesday, I said quickly. Don't worry about it. She said we could look at options. But I could hear the uncertainty creeping into her voice. A few minutes later, Jonathan, on the phone from Los Angeles, was working up a lather. He thought I should flout Greenberg's orders and call Kim Harris. He was incredulous at the legal arguments Oppenheim had raised. For any layperson with a dim recollection of the term, tortious interference was probably best known as the specious rationale used by CBS News' parent company to shut down that network's tobacco reporting. That day, McHugh and Jonathan both made the same comparison. "Hasn't anyone in this company seen The Insider?" Jonathan asked, exasperated. The next morning, I called Kim Harris's office several times before she responded by email. Harris wrote that she'd been traveling for several days. We could meet the following week, perhaps. But this would be too late for the McGowan interview. I pleaded. Canceling it could mean we don't get it back, I replied. I offered to pre-brief with Harris and let her dictate my posture in the interview, as I'd done with Chung before the early interviews. Then I called Wiener and left her a voicemail making the same points again. Susan, as a matter of record, I don't want us to have to be canceling reporting. I know you're both out, but please respond. As I hung up, Greenberg motioned me into his office. So, he said, I called Harvey back. What did you say? I asked. I told him legal is vetting it and nothing's running for now. He said Weinstein had told him he wanted to send a letter to NBC's legal department, and Greenberg had directed him to Susan Wiener. He may accuse you of maligning him in conversations, he added. I laughed. Greenberg stayed serious. Obviously, I've been incredibly careful not to malign him beyond asking neutral questions, I said. I'll stand by anything I've said or put in writing. Just be careful, Greenberg said. I asked him if he had any word on the McGowan interview, and he said legal was still deciding if it could go ahead. I thought of McGowan's fraying resolve, her reeling at my attempt to cancel. Not long after, word came back. My begging had worked. Legal would allow the interview to proceed the following week. But the wavering had exacted its toll. As they decided, McGowan texted, I can't film or be in your segment. I'm so sorry. The legal angle is coming at me, and I have no recourse. Over the following hours, my attempts to bring her back into the fold went nowhere. I'm hamstrung, she said finally. I can't talk. McGowan seemed increasingly distraught. In the following weeks, her lawyers would follow up with aggressive cease and desist letters. I walked into Greenberg's office and told him immediately. I'm going to try to get her back on board, I said. He thought for a moment, then shrugged. Honestly, it makes me less nervous if she's not in the script, he said. She always sounded a little, well, you know. Emily Nestor was close to going on camera full face. I can go back to her. Just wait, he said. It'd be calling an existing source. Let's just do this by the book from here. No new reporting for now, he said, as Oppenheim had. I got home from work and my phone chimed. Another text asking me to opt into weather alerts. I swiped it away. Another ping. This time it was an old school friend calling. I pressed my eyes shut. I can't go out, Aaron, I said. Aaron Fitzgerald had the kind of high-end consulting job that repeated explanations shed little light on. No one's seen you in like 6 months, she said, over a hum of cocktail conversation. What's going on with you? You know, on a big story. Whatever that means. Yeah, I said. Well, you're coming tonight. And she wouldn't take no for an answer. I sat with her and another friend on a crowded rooftop in Brooklyn and looked at the city and realized I'd barely left my apartment that summer. I'm on this assignment where I feel like I'm burning all my bridges one by one, I said. She shrugged. Here, come, she said, pulling me over to the parapet. We stood in front of the glittering Manhattan skyline and posed for a picture. The next day, Ostrovsky began his routine inspection of my social media accounts and those of my friends and relatives. Coming to an Instagram post showing me and a pretty girl against the Manhattan skyline, he lingered and felt, for a moment, relieved. I was in town, after all. By then, he and Haken had begun their latest assignment, but without much success. They'd billed a few hours following the woman from the New York Times, taking photographs of her on the subway, and then giving up after she disappeared into the Times building. The client's attention soon turned to the television reporter with the story that seemed to be in a state of flux. But this was proving to be a challenge, too. Seeing that I was on the Today Show one morning, Ostrovsky and Haken disagreed about how best to capitalize on the opportunity.
Hey, he's on the show, Ostrovsky had said.
Is it worth going to see if we get him coming out? Haken replied.
Ostrovsky thought about this. Something about it made him uncomfortable.
It's a really busy area, Rockefeller Center, he pointed out. We can't get there in a car. We don't have enough people to cover all the entrances and exits.
Not long after, as hot July gave way to a still hotter early August, I left home in the morning and walked right by the silver Nissan Pathfinder parked on the street immediately opposite my address. Only later did I register the memory of the two men sitting inside, one thin and bald, the other heavyset with dark, curly hair. All that spring and summer, headlines about harassment and abuse had picked up pace, a fresh round of stories about Fox News, more scrutiny about President Trump. I was starting to field inquiries from women's rights activists supportive of my reporting on gender discrimination. As Ostrovsky and Haken debated 30 Rockefeller Plaza's suitability for interception, one of those messages landed in my inbox, describing a women's advocacy program run by a wealth management company. It included a request to meet the following week. I glanced at the email and moved on without responding.
I am very impressed with your work as a male advocate for gender equality and believe that you would make an invaluable addition to our activities,
wrote Diana Phillip of Rubin Capital Partners. Chapter 23. Candy. The first week of August, I arrived at Harris's office in a light-filled corporate suite high in the building. Declining a call from my mother as I arrived, I texted her, going into meeting with parent company lawyer. Say a prayer. I had broken rank to contact Harris, and she hadn't added anyone to our emails. But Greenberg arrived a few minutes later, followed by Wiener. The difference between the two women in the room was elemental, almost atomic. While Wiener was quiet and bureaucratic, Harris possessed outsized charisma. She had graduated from the best Ivy League institutions in the sequence required to achieve maximum prestige. She'd worked in the Obama White House and as a partner at a top-ranked firm. She was faster on her feet than the company veterans in the room and less intent on ceremony. She had big, genial features and a quick smile. Harris was the deadliest kind of lawyer, one sophisticated enough that you didn't see her doing the work at all. She pulled out a copy of the script and ran through a few small language notes. And then, I also think we're open to a tortious interference argument. I kept my face composed. I wasn't about to parse case law with the company's general counsel, but I knew this was bullshit. Still, talking to Harris was generally reassuring. Her order, from a legal standpoint, separate from the news division's editorial decision, was not to stand down. She wanted another script, with the edits we'd discussed. A few hours later, on my way out of the building, I ran into Wiener. Outside, rain was pounding at the lobby's revolving doors. To my surprise, she fixed me with a meaningful stare and said, "Keep going." As the Weinstein story had expanded to fill more and more of McHugh's and my days and nights, I'd struggled to keep my canceled foreign policy book alive and find it a new publisher. All of the living secretaries of state had agreed to go on the record for the project, and I'd kept racing from our shoots into interviews with them. Hillary Clinton, who'd known about the book since I described it to her during my time working for her at the State Department, had agreed early and with enthusiasm. "Thank you, my friend, for your message. It is great hearing from you, and I am delighted to know that you are close to completing your book project," she wrote that July. The letter was printed on embossed stationery in a curly Art Deco font, like a New Yorker headline or a piece of set dressing from BioShock. It was very lovely, and not the sort of thing that wins Wisconsin. Several rounds of calls and emails had ensued, and an interview date had been promised that month, ahead of the beginning of a promotional tour for Clinton's latest memoir. The afternoon of the meeting with Harris, as I pushed through the downpour and into my building's front door, a call came in from Nick Merrill, Clinton's flack. We discussed the book briefly, and then he said,
"By the way, we know about the big story you're on."
I sat down on one of the chairs in my building's lobby. "Well, Nick, I'm probably working on a lot of stories at any given time. You know what I mean," he said.
"I really can't say anything."
"Well, you know, it's a concern for us." I felt a rivulet of rain run down my neck. "Can I ask who said this to you?" I said. "Maybe off the record, over drinks," he replied. "Let's just say people are talking." When I turned the conversation back to the interview with Clinton, he said that she was really busy with the book tour. I pointed out that this was why we'd scheduled the interview for before the book tour. "Like I said," he reiterated, as if he hadn't heard this, "really busy." Over the ensuing weeks, every attempt to lock a date for the interview yielded another terse note that she'd become suddenly unavailable. She'd injured her foot. She was too tired. Clinton, meanwhile, was becoming one of the most easily available interviews in all of politics. Later, Merrill would swear up and down that Clinton's sudden reticence was coincidental. Whatever the motivation, it felt ominous. Another screw turning, another sign of my life outside the story shrinking. It was hard not to sense a pattern forming. Each time we came back to our bosses with more reporting, word of the story seemed to spread farther. McHugh and I both worried about protecting our sources. "If someone's leaking to Clinton, what's getting leaked to Harvey?" McHugh wondered.
"Shit," I said. "You don't think they would..."
"I don't know," he said. "That's the problem."
As pressure on the story mounted, fissures between McHugh and me widened.
Our exchanges grew terse. After the meeting with Harris, he was miffed he hadn't been included and seemed to wonder where my loyalties lay. "Just odd that you ended up solo," he said. I explained that I'd been trying to leave the door open to a more candid one-on-one, that I hadn't known Greenberg would join. "Just don't want them isolating us," McHugh said, warily. As I arrived home from work one day early that August, my superintendent, squat and square-jawed and graying, approached me under the building's awning. He was annoyed.
"You know these guys outside today?" he said in an Albanian accent.
"What guys?" I asked.
"Two guys in car, smoking by car, all the time."
I looked up and down the block. The street was mostly empty.
"Why do you think they were here for me?"
He rolled his eyes.
"Ronan is always you. You move in, address print everywhere, now I have no peace."
I told him I was sure it was just TMZ guys on a slow day. "If they come back, I'll bring them coffee and ask them to leave," I said. He shook his head and looked at me doubtfully. It was clear that we could bring in more reporting if NBC wanted it. "I know you've been considering taking that last step and doing an interview showing your face," I told Nestor in a call as the review progressed. "I hate to put this on you, but it could be important if you do."
"I'm applying for jobs. I'm just not sure," she said. "I wouldn't be asking if I didn't think it might make the difference here."
She thought for a moment.
"If it winds up being that important, I'm open to it. I'd do it."
Despite the strange signals from our bosses, McHugh and I kept working. He helped with research, clicking over to other browser windows as Greenberg walked by. I stayed up late, calling Weinstein's former employees around the world. I needed the kind of big break that could shatter the halt on reporting. Leaving home one morning, I spotted something outside that made me stop abruptly. A silver Nissan Pathfinder I felt sure I'd seen before in the same spot. Other residents made their way into the sunlight. My neighbor, who looked a little like me, smiled as he passed. I stood there, feeling ridiculous. There were a million reasons for two guys to be parked near Columbus Circle a few times a week, I reminded myself. but I decided I'd have more privacy working from home anyway, and went back upstairs. It was a minute after noon when the call from Greenberg came in. "How's the script?" he asked. I'd been revising it according to Harris's specifications. "It's rock solid," I said, "and we're continuing to field any relevant incoming calls from sources, of course." "Legal called, and they want you to pause reporting," he said. This again, I thought. "Why?" I asked. "I assumed since they gave us the green light to go ahead with Rose..." "No, we're paused. How's your book? Interviews going well?"
Greenberg had never shown any interest in my book. We talked about Condoleezza Rice for a few minutes before I said,
"Rich, about stopping reporting..." "I gotta go," he interjected. "I'm flying to see my dad. I'll be gone all weekend. We can talk next week."
And then he was gone.
"Greenberg called," I texted McHugh. "Legal wants us to stop any new calls, so be discreet."
"Oh, shit," he wrote back. "Why?"
It didn't make sense. Discouragement was one thing, but there was no rationale, journalistic or legal, for ordering us to stop reporting. I called Greenberg again.
"Rich, I'm sorry to bother you again. I just need some clarification here. What exactly did legal say? Who in legal? Why?"
"I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I really have to go now. I have to catch my flight," he said quickly. As if to leaven the tone, he added, "Sorry, man." I was responding when he hung up. The call had lasted all of 37 seconds. I paced my apartment. I called Harris's office, said it was urgent, didn't hear back. My phone chimed. Another message from Diana Phillip of Rubin Capital Partners, entreating me to meet about my reporting on gender issues. Leaving home that afternoon, I edged up to the front door where I'd seen the car. Nothing there. "You look like a damn fool," I thought to myself. But I was starting to take precautions. I was memorializing sensitive information in longhand form. I was moving new documents into the safe deposit box. Eventually, I'd consult John Tai, a former whistleblower on government surveillance practices who founded a nonprofit law office called Whistleblower Aid. He set me up with an iPod Touch with only an encrypted messaging app installed, connected to the internet through an anonymous Wi-Fi hotspot purchased with cash. Its number was registered to a pseudonym. Mine was Candy.
"Oh, come on," I said, incredulous.
"I don't pick the names," Tai said, all serious.
"I sound like a nice Midwestern girl who should not have moved to L.A.
"I don't pick the names."
Chapter 24. Pause.
"I've been waiting for this call," a crisp English accent was saying. Ali Canosa, who'd worked for Weinstein since 2010, immediately confirmed she'd been aware of the pattern of honeypot meetings. And there was more. "I was sexually abused by Harvey Weinstein," she said. "Repeatedly." I took a risk, showed my cards, told Canosa exactly what I had.
"Oh my God," she said, beginning to break down. "It's finally going to come out."
When I asked if she'd go on camera, she sounded frightened, but open to the idea.
"I want to help," she said. "Let's talk."
She agreed to meet me in Los Angeles in person. She was available that weekend. When a source offers you a break like that, you grab it. I started the process of booking a plane ticket, then stopped. It was a Thursday afternoon. To make it to the meeting with Canosa over the weekend, I'd need to fly out soon. But Greenberg had just issued his latest order to stop reporting, this time invoking the legal department. McHugh again suggested asking for forgiveness, not permission. "If you don't explain this to anybody, you can guarantee this meeting. And you can see her this weekend and have a talk, and maybe convince her to go on camera. If you tell them, you let people far more powerful than we are in this scenario dictate what happens." But going truly rogue, rather than just keeping under the radar as we had that spring, felt like a bridge too far. I called Wiener and told her the interview was important. Then I sent an email pleading for permission to continue reporting. No one replied. "They're probably talking," McHugh texted. "Try to put it out of mind." I waited a day, then booked my ticket to L.A. It was raining again the next morning, an oppressive gray drizzle. McHugh called from the office early as I threw unfolded clothes into a suitcase.
"Didn't you say Greenberg was getting on a flight yesterday?"
McHugh asked. He was speaking under his breath.
"Yeah," I said. "He had to get off in a hurry."
"Funny," he said, "'cause he's here.
Maybe his flight got canceled."
"Maybe."
I was putting the luggage into the trunk of a sedan when Greenberg tried me. Then he texted.
"Call me ASAP."
Hi, I said. I'm on the way to the airport.
What?
He said. He sounded like he was about to leap out of his skin. I have to get Susan on the phone. Then she joined, speaking slowly and carefully.
We have discussed your email about this weekend's meeting. The company would like to put a pause on all reporting and contact with sources.
All contact with sources? I asked, incredulous. There was a heaviness to these conversations now, a strange sense that we were not just speaking to each other, but also turning out, just a bit, to the crowd that might someday scrutinize our decisions. I felt this, and then felt it might be self-aggrandizing. But it gave me a strange kind of authority to push them to say what they hoped to leave between the lines.
I don't understand, I continued. Has anyone at any point raised any issue with the reporting or how I've acted?
No, no, Greenberg said. Is there any question about the news value of this woman offering to discuss a serious allegation of sexual abuse by a prominent person?
That's above my pay grade, he managed.
Okay, so where's this coming from?
Is this an order from legal? I asked.
There followed a silence that felt endless.
It's not, Wiener began. You should know this comes directly from Noah, Greenberg said.
So legal hasn't made a determination that I should stop reporting?
Noah has made a determination that we should pause reporting and contact with sources.
No one has expressed a rationale as to why it would place us in any jeopardy to allow reporting to continue with full caution and in full consultation with legal. Did he articulate any reason why?
Well, if I had to guess from my standpoint, Wiener stammered, I'd say one might want to review what we have now before continuing with anything new.
She assembled this sentence like she was reading characters off a newly unearthed cuneiform tablet.
This isn't new, I said stubbornly, referring to the meeting with Canosa. It's been scheduled.
The phone vibrated, McHugh calling. I declined the call, typed in a text. On with Greenberg and Wiener. Should I join? He responded. It felt like a rescue operation.
Maybe poke head in? I wrote. In light of what Noah said, we think you should not be meeting with any sources, Greenberg was saying.
McHugh texted to say Greenberg had waved away the attempt to enter his office. No rescue.
I can't prevent sources from reaching out to me, I told Greenberg. We understand that, he said.
I said nothing about whether I would obey the order to cancel the meeting, agreeing instead to keep them apprised of what Canosa told me, if we had any contact. I'd never experienced this before, pretending I wasn't contacting sources, feigning reluctance to hear back from them.
I think she will very possibly agree to go on camera, I said, and if she does, I'll feel strongly about proceeding with that. We'd have to go back to Noah on that, Greenberg said.
I got off the call feeling disoriented. I called Jonathan.
This is insane, he said. I don't think I can risk trying to cancel another interview, I said. You and Rich McHugh need to start writing each other memos, detailed descriptions of all of this, sent in real time. They're saying incriminating shit.
I looked out of the car window at a snarl of bumper-to-bumper traffic outside JFK.
This is all fine for you guys, Jonathan was saying. As long as you keep going, as long as you keep reporting.
Easy for you to say, I told him.
I'm pissing them off with this stuff. I'm going to be unemployed soon at this rate. Who cares? Look at what's happening. No one on these calls wants to own any of this because it's so obviously bad. It's like a reverse murder on the Orient Express. Everybody wants it dead. Nobody wants to stab it.
Back at 30 Rockefeller Plaza, McHugh, still lingering outside Greenberg's office, knocked again. What's going on? McHugh said.
Noah has asked us to pause our reporting while we see what we have and the legal review takes place, Greenberg told him.
I just don't understand that, McHugh said. Greenberg hadn't offered any explanations on the phone with me, and he didn't offer any to McHugh. He rattled off a list of Weinstein's lawyers, Charles Harder, David Boies, and a new name McHugh hadn't heard in connection with Weinstein before, Lanny Davis.
Not that we're afraid of any of them, Greenberg added. But for the time being, you have to stop any calls about this.
As I had, McHugh said he couldn't stop incoming calls, and left it at that. As I arrived at JFK, Canosa called. She sounded nervous.
You're still coming to town? She asked.
I stopped for a moment, anxious travelers dragging heavy luggage coursing around me. I thought how easy it would be to tell her no, to take the order from our bosses, to safeguard the relationships with Greenberg and Oppenheim. Ronan? She asked again. Yeah, I told her. I'm coming. From the plane, I put the finishing touches on the script, trading notes with McHugh about a word choice in my narration or an edit on a soundbite. Even pared down to the elements the legal department had reviewed and sanctioned, it was explosive. I'm used to that, said Weinstein near the top, as Gutierrez, panicked, tried to escape. NBC News has exclusively obtained audio collected during the NYPD sting, I narrated. Gutierrez was named, her story told in detail, followed by a summary paragraph. NBC News has spoken to four other women who have worked for Weinstein and who allege sexual misconduct, allegations dating from the late 1990s to just 3 years ago. Nestor's interview was included, and the messages from writer corroborating her claim, and soundbites from the executives describing firsthand recollections of misconduct. I attached to the script a note that I hoped would put our bosses at NBC on notice about Canosa. Rich, attached, please find the script, revised according to Kim and Susan's enumerated concerns and your subsequent suggestions, which have been followed very precisely. Please note that one additional former assistant has raised a credible firsthand allegation of sexual abuse and claims to have a paper trail relevant to our reporting. She has expressed a willingness to participate in this story and is deciding in what capacity. Ronan. After the email went out to Greenberg and Wiener, I felt antsy. I depressed the button on my seat and tested the limits of its recline a few times. It felt like we were standing still while the outside world accelerated. While I was on the flight, Huff Post ran a story about claims that Fox News host Eric Bolling had sent lewd texts to coworkers. The story had used entirely anonymous sourcing, something that had never been the case in any draft of ours. The same afternoon, The Hollywood Reporter announced that Harvey Weinstein, for his contributions to public discourse and the cultural enlightenment of society, would be receiving the LA Press Club's inaugural Truth Teller Award. Chapter 25. Pundit. I met Ali Canosa at a restaurant way out on the east end of Sunset Boulevard. She sat perfectly upright, every muscle in her body tensed. Like many of the sources in the Weinstein story, she was pretty in a way that would have been striking in most settings, but was just a criterion for employment in Hollywood. Canosa wasn't sure what to do. She had signed a non-disclosure agreement as a condition of her employment with Weinstein. She was still trying to make it as a producer and was terrified of retaliation. Weinstein could render her unemployable. And then there were the hesitations of any survivor of sexual violence. She'd allowed her wounds to calcify and learned to carry on. She hadn't told her father or her boyfriend.
I don't want to suffer more, you know? She told me.
Once, as she'd worked up the nerve to raise the matter with a therapist,
I saw her at a premiere for a Weinstein movie, Canosa told me. I found out she was a producer on one of Harvey's movies.
Canosa had met Weinstein the better part of a decade earlier when she was working as an event planner at the West Hollywood branch of the members-only club Soho House. She'd organized an event for the Weinstein Company, and he'd spotted her, stared, and then handed her his business card. At first, Weinstein almost stalked Canosa, demanding to meet again and again. When she was creeped out and didn't respond, he forced her hand, demanding a formal meeting through Soho House, ostensibly to discuss another event. At the Montage Hotel, their midday meeting was moved to a hotel suite, and Weinstein laid into her with his familiar promises of career advancement, followed by sexual overtures. "You should be an actress," she remembered him saying. "You have a face." When he asked, "You're not going to kiss me?" she said no and left, flustered. She kept trying to ignore him, but he was persistent, and she was fearful of the impact he might have on her career if she spurned him. She agreed to meet again. During dinner at a hotel restaurant, Eva Cassidy's cover of Autumn Leaves drifted over the stereo system. Canosa talked about Cassidy's life story, and Weinstein proposed developing a biopic about her with Canosa's help. After the meal, he grabbed her by the arm, pressed her against a railing on the steps outside, and kissed her hard. She was horrified. But afterward, Weinstein made a big show of being apologetic, she said. "We can just be friends," she remembered him telling her. "I really want to make this movie with you." He set up a call with a veteran producer of his, and pretty soon they were meeting with rights holders and exchanging script notes.
I called my parents and was like, oh my god, you would not believe what just happened. Harvey Weinstein wants me to help him produce a movie about an idea I gave him, she recalled. So naive. Look, it's embarrassing just talking about it, but at the time I was like, this is all I ever wanted.
Kanosa took time to get to these points. After our meeting at the restaurant, she said she'd be more comfortable in private and came to Jonathan's place in West Hollywood. It was the start of a trend that would soon see more and more distraught sources traipsing through his doors. Pundit, the golden doodle my mother had given Jonathan, curled up next to Kanosa as she continued the story. The first year they'd worked together, Kanosa had tried repeatedly to brush off Weinstein's advances. During one meeting about the Cassidy film, he casually told her he needed to go up to his hotel room to get something.
It was like mid-afternoon or something, so I just didn't think, she said.
When they got there, he told her he was going to take a shower.
Would you get in the shower with me? He asked.
No, Kanosa told him.
Just get in the shower with me. I don't even need to. I don't want to have sex with you. I just want you to be in the shower with me.
No, she said again and went into the living room.
Weinstein announced from the bathroom that he was going to masturbate anyway and started doing so through the open door as she averted her gaze. She left Weinstein's hotel room, upset. Another time, Weinstein left a jacket behind at one of their meetings and asked her to hold on to it. In its pockets, she found a pack of syringes that Googling revealed were a treatment for erectile dysfunction. She reeled at the implications of him arming himself for sex ahead of their meetings. By then, she was working on the film for Weinstein. Her professional life had come to revolve around him. And they had developed a friendship that was real, if twisted by imbalances of power and by Weinstein's overtures. At one work dinner with a number of colleagues that summer, he wept over news that Disney would be selling Miramax. He asked her yet again to come to his hotel room. When she refused, he roared at her, "Don't fucking refuse me when I'm crying!" She relented, and nothing happened. He just sobbed. "I've never been happy," she remembered him saying. "You're one of my best friends. You're so loyal." She hoped the declarations of friendship meant he understood her boundaries. She was wrong.
What came next, she said, beginning to cry, was he raped me.
The first time had been after another meeting in a hotel. As they discussed the Cassidy project, he said a scene in the script reminded him of a classic film and asked her to come up to his room to watch a clip. Weinstein had by then apologized for his advances profusely, and he was, after all, her boss.
I was like, I can handle myself, she said.
The only television in Weinstein's hotel room was in the bedroom. She sat on the bed and watched the clip, feeling uncomfortable.
He made a move, and I told him no, and he made another move, and I told him no, she recalled.
Weinstein got angry, aggressive.
Don't be a fucking idiot, she remembered him saying.
He departed for the restroom and returned a few minutes later, wearing only a robe. Then he pushed her onto the bed.
I said no more than once, and he forced himself on me, she said. It wasn't like I was screaming, but I was definitely like, I don't want to do this. And his full body weight was on top of me.
Kanosa lingered on what she could have done differently.
In my head at the time, it was like I didn't put up enough of a fight.
Eventually, she stopped saying no.
I was just numb. I wasn't crying. I was just staring at the ceiling.
It was only after she left that she started sobbing and couldn't stop. Weinstein hadn't used protection. He had told her, to her great discomfort months earlier, how he'd gotten a vasectomy. But she was terrified he might have given her an STD. She thought of telling her boyfriend, but felt too ashamed.
Looking back, I would drag myself kicking and screaming straight to the police if I could.
As she broke down, telling the story, Pundit leapt up, concerned, trying to lick Kanosa's face. She laughed, relieved to have the tension of the moment punctured.
This is the sweetest dog I think I've ever met, she said.
Kanosa kept working for Weinstein.
I was in a vulnerable position and I needed my job, she told me.
Later, when she lost her job at a different production company, she signed a formal contract with the Weinstein Company, working on awards campaigns for The Artist and The Iron Lady. Weinstein's misconduct continued. Once, he ordered her to accompany him to an appointment with an osteopath and to remain in the room as he stripped naked and received treatment for a worsening case of sciatica. Another time, during an attack of the same condition, he demanded that she massage his thighs. She remembered him screaming at her when she refused.
What the fuck? Why aren't you gonna? Why?
Because I don't feel comfortable, she told him. I'm your employee.
For fuck's sake, Allie, he shouted. For fuck's sake, you can massage my thighs.
I'm just not going to.
Then fucking get out of here. Fuck you. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
When she was working on the production of the Netflix series Marco Polo, Weinstein arrived on set in Malaysia and wreaked havoc. At a dinner for the directors and producers, he demanded, in front of her co-workers, that she go to his hotel room. When she tried to go instead to her own room, the barrage of texts from his assistants started up.
Harvey wants to see you. Harvey wants to see you.
Sometimes her efforts to evade him failed, and more assaults followed. Later, court documents would itemize oral sexual conduct or anal sexual conduct with plaintiff by forcible compulsion and or when plaintiff was incapable of consent by reason of being physically helpless. All around Canosa, there were signs that she wasn't alone. During that same visit to the set of Marco Polo, Weinstein went into the dressing room of one actress for 15 minutes,
and then she was a ghost of herself for a week afterwards.
Canosa felt a moral obligation to do something, but was terrified by Weinstein's displays of vindictiveness.
The number of times I've seen people have their lives threatened, or their wives threatened, or their reputation threatened, she said, shaking her head.
I tried to be honest with Canosa about the precariousness of the story and the importance of her participation to its future. I said, as I had so many times that summer, that the decision was hers, that all I could do was tell her how sincerely I believed talking would make a difference for a lot of people. By the end of our conversations, she was edging tantalizingly close to saying yes to going on camera. Chapter 26. Boy. It was early evening and the shadows were lengthening in Harvey Weinstein's offices on Greenwich Street when the call came in.
Can you get Harvey? Said George Pataki, the former New York governor. An assistant made the connection. Hey, Harvey, it's George. I just want to let you know, Ronan Farrow's still working on the story.
That's not what I hear, Weinstein said.
Pataki insisted that multiple women were talking to me. He's ready to go with it. It's supposed to get aired.
When? Weinstein asked. When is it supposed to get aired?
2 to 3 weeks, Pataki said.
Nowhere was Weinstein more deeply enmeshed in politics than in New York. Between 1999 and that summer in 2017, he and his company had given to at least 13 New York politicians or their PACs. He'd covered his bases, mostly with Democrats, but also occasionally with Republicans like Pataki. He'd been generous with Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and Governor Andrew Cuomo. For Weinstein and Pataki, as had been the case with Hillary Clinton, campaign contributions had helped foster friendship. The former governor was often photographed at the movie mogul's events. Weinstein helped boost the career of Pataki's daughter, Allison, an historical novelist. A year before Pataki's call, Weinstein hosted a book party for her. The year before that, when her husband suffered a stroke, Weinstein helped secure the right specialists. Allison Pataki's book agent, Lacey Lynch, also worked with McGowan. As the summer wore on, Lynch's name began showing up on Weinstein's email and call lists. Weinstein had kept up his calls to boys about the NBC problem. After his conversation with Lack, he'd continued to reach out to NBC executives and had confidently reported back to people around him that the story was dead. But it wasn't long before he called boys back, sounding less certain.
I think NBC is still working on a story, he said.
He sounded angry.
I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
After hearing from Pataki, Weinstein placed a fresh round of calls to Phil Griffin, Andy Lack, and Noah Oppenheim. He'd shouted the names so often.
Get me Phil. Get me Andy. Get me Noah.
The assistants had taken to calling them the Triumvirate. By that August, Weinstein's attention was increasingly turning to Oppenheim. But Griffin, whom Weinstein told his staff he knew best, had been an object of early and intense focus and continued to be a mainstay. Griffin's carefree qualities contributed to his considerable charm. They could also, however, be a source of discomfort for colleagues. He had a temper and cursed like a sailor. He was notorious for his hard drinking after work. While he was a senior producer at Nightly News in the 90s, he'd often retire after work to Hurley's, a midtown bar. After a few drinks one night, he told three women producers with him that he wanted to go to Times Square.
I
want
to go see the lights at Times Square. I love to see the lights, one recalled Griffin saying.
Griffin moved the drinking to a Times Square hotel. Then the group stumbled over to 8th Avenue, where Griffin urged the women to come with him to see a peep show. Two of them exchanged uncomfortable glances. He told them to lighten up. In they went to a circle of darkened booths upstairs, where a window opened, and a woman, naked but for her heels, squatted in front of them and asked Griffin for some cash to continue the show. Griffin looked at the women with what one described as a flicker of shame. He told the stripper no thanks. The window closed, and the group headed out to exchange awkward goodbyes. For the women, the incident had been gross but unremarkable. They'd all come up in the business with this kind of behavior from men. Four colleagues said Griffin was known for making lewd or crass remarks in work emails. In one meeting I'd been in after the television personality Maria Menounos' vagina had been photographed in a bathing suit wardrobe malfunction, Griffin waved around a printed page bearing a zoomed-in image, smirking. "Would you look at that," he said, and exhaled hard. "Not bad, not bad." On a couch nearby, the female employee in the room with us rolled her eyes. Griffin seemed to see the news purely as a business and evinced for journalism little of the fervor he held for sports. When the winds of the industry blew in favor of partisanship, he pushed his anchors toward opinion. When partisanship wore thin, he was the first to turn to straight news. And when you subjected him to any kind of rigorous discussion of reporting, he'd squint at you and look confused. But Griffin did become passionate when a business interest was on the line. Once, while I was co-hosting a charity concert called the Global Citizen Festival, a big, earnest, low-rent Live Aid, I interviewed the concert's headline act, No Doubt. One of the festival's goals that year was promoting vaccination, even as the anti-vaxxer movement in the United States was producing adherence and measles outbreaks. I asked Gwen Stefani if she vaccinated her kids and how she felt about the anti-vaxxers. She said she supported vaccines and advised people to talk to their doctors. Mike Wallace at your door, this was not. But back at Rockefeller Plaza, assembling the spot in edit, I got a call from an MSNBC producer working on the concert. "Stefani's people have reviewed the transcript, and they'd like some edits," she said. "Who sent them the transcript?" I don't know." In my inbox was a redlined script, with Stefani's soundbites rearranged and trimmed to make it sound like she was ambivalent to negative on the vaccine front. I told the producer I wouldn't air it. Pretty soon, I was in Griffin's office with him and another member of his team. "What the fuck?" he asked, exasperated. I looked at the proposed script in front of me. "Phil, I'm not going to edit sound bites to change their meaning." "Why not?" he said, like this was the craziest thing he'd ever heard. "It's not ethical," I offered, less as a statement and more as a kind of reminder, hoping Griffin's question had been rhetorical and he'd finish the thought. Instead, he leaned back in his chair and directed a "Lord give me strength" look at his colleague. She tried a gentler tone. "We all know you care a lot about the," she hesitated here, seeming to genuinely struggle to find a nice way to put it, "journalism with a capital J, but this is not some sensitive political story." "It's a puff piece," Griffin chimed in. "Come on, what the fuck? There are literally kids dying over this issue. She's a famous person. Since when do we send transcripts of interviews outside the building anyway?" "We don't know how that happened," his colleague began. "Who cares?" Griffin interjected, impatient. "You know what happens if we don't make these edits? Stefani's threatening to pull out. That's straight from her manager." "That's who made these edits?" Griffin blew past the question. "Point is, she pulls out, sponsors start to pull out, the network's pissed." The channel's partnership with the Global Citizen Festival was, Griffin often remarked, bait to entice corporate sponsors. For weeks, we would run branded segments about Unilever or Caterpillar. "So let's not air it," I said. "You have to air it," said Griffin. "Why?" "It's part of the deal with the sponsors, with her people." "We ran this all the way up," his colleague said, referring to the executive chain of command in the newsgroup. "Your concerns are not shared." Griffin said he'd tell me what he told another anchor trying to air a tough segment about net neutrality, the principle that internet providers shouldn't charge different rates for different types of data on the internet, which our parent company was lobbying against. "You want to work for PBS and have complete freedom and make $100,000 a year? Be my guest," he recalled telling that anchor. "You want to fight with me on what's good for the bottom line? I'll be happy to put your salary numbers out in the press." I considered quitting. I called Tom Brokaw, who said I, under no circumstances, could air soundbites with deceptive edits, and gave me the same warning about fucking my credibility that he'd later lay on me during the Weinstein reporting. Then I called Savannah Guthrie, who had a knack for cutting through bullshit.
What about just not airing that part of the interview? She suggested.
I mean, it was most of the interview, I said.
Just find something else to air.
It was simple and, in hindsight, obvious advice. Don't air the deceptive part, but don't self-immolate over a singer's backstage interview. Picking the right fights was a lesson I could be slow to learn. In the end, I sat at the anchor's desk and aired a 5-minute clip of small talk with no doubt. I felt neither hella good nor hella bad. 2 years later, as Weinstein continued his calls to the triumvirate of executives, he reached Griffin.
I thought this was done, Weinstein said.
Harvey, it is, Griffin responded.
You need to get your boy in line, he said.
He sounded angry.
Harvey, Griffin said, defensive, he's not running it with us.
Later, Griffin would deny he ever promised the story was killed. It was, by the estimate of multiple staffers in Weinstein's office, one of at least 15 calls between Weinstein and the three NBC executives. And by late summer, Weinstein's mood after the calls had again become triumphal. Weinstein told one of his legal advisors that he'd spoken to executives at the network and that,
they tell me they're not doing the story.
Chapter 27. Alter. The news from the executive suites of NBC Universal at first seemed good. Early that August, Greenberg called to report that legal had signed off on the pared-down version of the script. And from the editorial side, he added, my view is everything in there is reportable. So we seek comment. We go into edit, I said.
Reportable doesn't mean it airs. Now it goes to Noah and Andy.
But surely if legal approved and you consider it reportable,
what they decide's above my pay grade, he said. There may be questions that have nothing to do with what's reportable. They may have concerns about whether it's good TV. You know, you have an incredible print piece, an incredible Vanity Fair story here.
What? Was all I managed.
You know, it'd make a perfect Vanity Fair story, he repeated.
Later, McHugh and I sat in a conference room and puzzled over the comment. Maybe he's right, he said heavily. Maybe you save this by taking it to somewhere else.
Rich, you know if that happens, you get screwed.
He had produced the hell out of the story as a television piece. We'd shot, by this point, 8 on-camera interviews. All of that would fall by the wayside in the scenario Greenberg had lightly proposed. And even if I wanted to take it elsewhere, would it be possible? The footage was owned by NBC Universal and, in turn, the Comcast Corporation. We were running this here, I said firmly, produced by you. McHugh said, okay, and sounded less certain. It rained ceaselessly that day. In my inbox, inquiries unrelated to the Weinstein story piled up. Diana Phillip, the investor with the Women's Rights Project, sent another email, this time through my agents at CAA. The messages related to the story were more anxiety-inducing. One arrived, blunt and short, from Oleta. Ronan, Harvey status? Ken. I made my way down through the bowels of 30 Rock onto a D-train. It was sparsely populated, despite the rain. I saw something, or thought I did, and froze. There, in profile, seated on my side at the opposite end of the car, was a bald head that I swore I'd seen in the Nissan. I could make out the same pale face and snub nose. I couldn't be sure. My most rational self thought, you're seeing things. But as the train stopped, I felt uncomfortable enough to slip out before my station. I pushed onto the crowded platform, looking over my shoulder. Outside, New York was a dreamscape, streets and buildings and people suspended in mist and rain. I walked fast, stopping at a CVS, scanning to see if I recognized anyone from the subway car or the platform. When I emerged, the light was failing. I came to the familiar fortress-like church near my apartment and moved quickly up the steps and walked through the doors. Where my damp shirt hadn't adhered to my body, rain rolled down the small of my back, my chest, my arms. The nave was smaller than I'd expected from the outside. Under imposing stained glass windows, an altar loomed. I stood in front of it, feeling out of place. By the altar was a seal in inlaid marble, showing a book and a sword over a diagram of the earth, the coat of arms of St. Paul.
Praedicator veritatis in universo mundo.
I had to Google the translation later. a preacher of truth to the whole world.
"We've been watching you,"
said a heavily accented voice near me, and I lurched. It was an older woman with dark hair. Next to her was a younger woman. They looked alarmed at my reaction.
"We've been watching," she said again, "from the beginning, your show. My daughter is a big fan."
"Oh," I said, "thank you," and then, collecting myself, managed a smile and a stock joke about low ratings. "You and my mom and no one else." I had arrived home when Berger, my agent at CAA, called.
"Ronan," he boomed, "how's it going?"
"I'm fine," I said.
"You're better than fine, you're fantastic," he said.
And then, a little quieter, descending into brisk efficiency.
"Look, I don't know the details of this big story."
"Did Noah mention it?" I asked. Berger was agent to both of us, and closer to Oppenheim.
"Ronan, I don't know a thing," he said.
He reminded me that my contract was about to be up for renewal.
"I'm just saying, if this is causing you problems, prioritize the stuff that's working."
I chewed my lip for a second, then dialed my sister.
"So, how's the story?" she asked.
"I don't know how it is, honestly."
"Don't you have, like, literally a recording of him admitting to it?"
"Yeah," I said.
"So, I've been pushing. I don't know how much more I can push."
"So you're gonna drop it?"
"It's not that simple. I might have to prioritize other things while I figure this out."
"I know what it's like to have people stop fighting for you," she said quietly. And there was a long silence before we said our goodbyes. It was dark by then. I looked at my phone and found Oppenheim had texted.
"Let's talk tomorrow. One's good."
I went over to my laptop and opened up a Microsoft Word document. "Other stories," I typed, and then hit delete a few times and replaced other with upcoming. I pasted in bullet points for two stories we were in the midst of shooting on healthcare consolidation and opioid-dependent infants, and a handful of others Oppenheim had liked before, including a vicey travelogue on Facebook's server farm deep in the permafrost of Luleå, Sweden. "It looks like a Bond villain's lair," I had written of the server farm, and other escapist TV pablum followed. Luleå is one of the busiest ports in Sweden and a major hub of its steel industry, but of this I knew nothing. I was picturing a place big and brisk and empty where a person could breathe and you could see the northern lights. At 30 Rock, McHugh stepped into an elevator, turned to find Wiener standing next to him, and smiled. But as she said hello back, she flinched and looked at her feet. Chapter 28 Pavanine. During my years at 30 Rock, the third floor waiting area, outside of the news executives' offices, cycled through several arrangements of furniture. That August, there was a low chair and a little table with a fan of the kind of months-old magazines that tend to ornament waiting rooms. A Time cover, jet black with blood-red lettering, asked, "Is truth dead?" It was an homage to a classic 60s Time cover that read, "Is God dead?" But not as good. It had been an impossible task. Truth just didn't fit like God did, despite valiant efforts at kerning. I looked at it, then went over to Oppenheim's assistant, Anna, to make small talk.
"Guess you guys are working on something big," she said, and gave me a conspiratorial, mum's the word smile.
When I walked into Oppenheim's office, he didn't rise or move to the couch as usual. He looked nervous.
"So, where's your head at?" I asked.
I had, folded in one hand, the printout of the alternative stories list.
Maybe Berger was right. Maybe I could turn from the terrible topic at hand. Leaven things. Refocus.
Oppenheim shifted in his seat.
"Well," he said, picking up a copy of the script, "we have some anonymous sourcing in here."
"We're leading with a woman we name. We're showing her face. We're hearing her voice," I said, referring to Gutierrez. He let out an exasperated breath.
"I don't know how credible she is. I mean, his lawyers are going to say they're in a public place, nothing actually happens. But he admits to something having happened before, something serious and specific. We've gone over this. He's trying to get rid of her. And anyway, you say right here," he flipped to the relevant section of the script, "she's got credibility problems."
"No," I said. "We've got sources on the force, sources in the DA's office saying she was credible."
"It says right here in the approved script," he said.
"Noah, I wrote the script. We're disclosing the stuff that got thrown at her, but the DA, the cops, the DA didn't go with it. And he's gonna say she's some hooker,
Okay, so we disclose all of that, and we let the public listen and decide.
He shook his head, looked at the page again.
And it's... how serious is this stuff, really?
He asked, as he had in each of our conversations about the story. As we spoke, a conversation came back to me from the year before, during the campaign. At the NBC cafeteria, I'd sat with Oppenheim, a green juice, in front of me. He'd leaned in, a little more gossipy than usual, and said that women at NBC News had reported harassment by a Trump campaign official on the trail. That's a huge story, I said. We can't tell it, Oppenheim replied with a shrug. They don't want to anyway. Well, surely there's a way to document it without violating confidences. It's just not gonna happen, he told me, as if to say, that's life, with the nonchalance and confidence I so admired at the time. So much so that I didn't give it, or his wider views on sexual harassment, more thought. During his years as a writer at the Harvard Crimson, Oppenheim had styled himself as a provocateur. He would pose as an earnest attendee at gatherings of feminist groups, then turn out fiery columns in the Crimson about how these groups were full of shit. While columnists don't always write their own headlines, Oppenheim's pieces had titles like Reading Clit Notes and Transgender Absurd, which accurately reflected their content. There's no question that my most impassioned adversaries have been the members of organized feminist groups, he wrote. The vitriol of their rhetoric has gone unmatched. Of course, so has their hypocrisy. Apparently, it is easy to blame the patriarchy for all of your woes and to silence your opponents with accusations of misogyny, but it is more difficult to actually deny oneself the pleasures of cavorting with said patriarchy's handsome sons. I will never forget the fateful evening when I encountered the leader of one prominent women's organization emerging from the anteroom of the Porcellian, an all-male social club. It seems that political dogmatism comes easy, so long as it does not interfere with one's plans for Saturday night. After attending a meeting related to the merger of Radcliffe, Harvard's former women's college, with the Maine undergraduate school, young Noah Oppenheim wrote, "Why are women's meetings any more deserving of protected space than anyone else's?" In a column defending the good old days of same-sex clubs at Harvard, he argued,
"To the angry feminists, there is nothing wrong with single-sex institutions.
Men, just like women, need to themselves. We need a place to let our baser instincts have free rein, to let go of whatever exterior polish we affect to appease female sensibilities." He added that women who feel threatened by the club's environments should seek tamer pastures. However, apparently, women enjoy being confined, pumped full of alcohol, and preyed upon. They feel desired, not demeaned.
Years had passed, and Noah Oppenheim had matured. But that day in 2017, as I watched him shift and gaze down, I had a sense that part of his vulnerability to criticism of the story was a sincere belief. That this just wasn't a huge deal, some Hollywood bully, famous in Soho and Cannes, crossing a line.
"Megyn Kelly did that story about women in tech, and we had a couch full of women," he was telling me.
"If what you're saying is you sincerely just want more, then tell me," I said. "There's more we can get in place quickly." He seemed not to hear this.
"The temp is in shadow," he said.
"She'll go full face. She said she'll do it if we need it." He swallowed hard, laughed a little.
"Well, I don't know," he said. "It depends what she has to say."
"We know what she has to say. She has evidence. She has messages from an executive within the company.
Well, I don't know if we want that. I don't know. And there's a third woman, as I've mentioned, with a rape allegation.
Noah, she's close to going on camera. If what you're saying is we need more, I will get us more."
"Now, just a second. I don't know if we'd have to check with legal before we do anything like that."
He seemed frustrated, like he'd expected this to be easier. His face was going pale and slick, as it had when he listened to the audio.
"That's the problem, Noah," I said. "Every time we try to get more, you guys push back."
This seemed to make him angry.
"Well, none of this matters," he said. "We've got a much bigger problem."
He smacked onto the desk a printed page, then leaned back. I picked it up. It was a Los Angeles Times article from the early 1990s describing Weinstein agreeing to distribute Woody Allen's movies.
"Harvey says you've got a huge conflict of interest," Oppenheim said.
I looked up from the page.
"Harvey says?"
Oppenheim's gaze shifted off to the side again.
"You know, Harvey told Rich Greenberg. I never talked to Harvey."
But we knew this, I said, puzzled. Greenberg and McHugh and I searched and found he'd worked with both my parents. He worked with everyone in Hollywood.
He worked with Woody Allen when he was a pariah.
He was raising his voice now. A lot of distributors worked with him.
It doesn't matter. It's not about that. It's your sister was sexually assaulted. You wrote that Hollywood Reporter piece last year about sexual assault in Hollywood. It caused this splash.
What are you arguing, I asked, that no one with a family member who's been sexually assaulted can report on sexual assault issues? He shook his head.
No, he said, this goes directly to the heart of your agenda.
Do you think I have an agenda, Noah? I had the same feeling I'd had in the conversation with Greenberg, that I had to ask direct questions because it was the only way to expose the space between what he was willing to imply and what he was willing to say.
Of course not, Oppenheim said. But I know you. That's not what this is about. This is about public narrative, and the public narrative is going to be, I let Ronan Farrow, who just came out as this sexual assault crusader, hating his father. This wasn't a crusade. It was an assignment you gave me.
I don't remember that, he said. I don't think I would have done that. Well, it's true. I didn't pitch this of my own initiative, and I didn't report it alone either. This is something your whole news organization worked on. I slid the printout back across the desk to him. We knew he was going to try to smear me in some way, I said. If this is the best he's got, honestly, I'm relieved. And you should be, too. I'd be happier, he said, agitated, if he'd found a video of you fucking in a bathroom or something.
The friendship we'd had, which might have made this gay joke merit an eye roll and a laugh, was giving way to something else, where he was just a boss and a network head, and I was annoyed by it.
Insane, Jonathan would later yell at no one in particular. It's insane for him to actually present that article seriously. It's not serious. It's not a real objection. It's fully fucking slimy.
Later, every journalist I consulted, Auletta, Brokaw even, would say that there was no conflict, that it was a non-issue. What Oppenheim was describing was a journalist caring about a topic, not having a conflict with a specific person. Even so, I told him I'd be more than happy to put a disclosure on the story. An almost pleading look crossed Oppenheim's face.
I'm not saying there isn't a lot here. This is an incredible,
he searched for the end of the sentence,
an incredible New York Magazine piece. And you know, you want to take it to New York Magazine? Go with God. Go with God.
He put up his hands in a gesture of surrender. I looked at him like he was crazy for a moment, and then asked,
Noah, is this story dead or not?
He looked at the script again. Over his shoulder, I saw the deco architecture of historic Rockefeller Plaza. I thought of my sister. 5 years earlier, she'd first told the family she wanted to revive her allegation of sexual assault against Woody Allen. We'd stood in the TV room at our home in Connecticut, with stacks of fading VHS tapes.
I don't see why you can't just move on, I told her. You had that choice, she said. I didn't. We have all spent decades trying to put this thing behind us. I'm just now trying to launch something serious where people focus on the work, and you want to reset the clock completely. This isn't about you, she said. Don't you see that? No, it's about you. You're smart. You're talented. You have so many other things you can do, I said. But I can't, because it's always there, she said.
And then she was crying.
You do not need to do this, and you are ruining your life if you do. Fuck you, she said. I support you, but you have to stop.
Oppenheim was looking up from the page.
I can go back to the group, but right now, we can't run this.
Alan Berger's creaky voice drifted through my mind. Prioritize the stuff that's working. I wondered if I had it in me to say, okay, to turn to other things, to focus on the future. In hindsight, it's clear, but in the moment, you don't know how important a story is going to be. You don't know if you're fighting because you're right, or because of your ego and your desire to win and to avoid confirming what everyone thought, that you were young and inexperienced and in over your head. I looked at the story list on my lap. I'd been gripping it so hard it was twisted and moist with sweat. The words, "Looks like a Bond villain's lair," peeked up at me. Just beyond my field of vision, the aurora flashed. Oppenheim was studying me. He said there couldn't be any more work under the aegis of NBC News. He said,
I can't have you going to any more sources.
I thought of McGowan under the TV lights saying,
I hope they're brave, too.
Nestor, falling into shadow, wondering, is this the way the world works? Gutierrez, listening as Weinstein said, I'm used to that. Annabella Sciorra telling me, I'm sorry. I looked at Oppenheim, hard. No, I said. He looked annoyed.
Excuse me?
No, I said again. I'm not going to, whatever you said, stop contact with sources. I balled up the page in my hand. A lot of women have risked a lot to get this out and are still risking a lot. This is the problem, he said, picking up volume. You're too close to this. I considered whether this could be true. Aletta had said he had a fixation on the story. I guessed I did, too. But I had also grilled these sources, and I was skeptical, ready to follow the facts wherever they led, and I was eager to go to Weinstein for comment, which I had not been allowed to do. Okay, so I'm close to it, I said. So I care. We have evidence, Noah, and if there's a chance of exposing this before it happens to anyone again, then I can't stop. I wanted this to sound masculine and assertive, but I could hear my voice cracking. If you're sending me packing, this is your news organization and that's your call, I continued. But you need to tell me. I'm not sending you packing, he said, but he was looking away again. There was a long beat, and then he shot me a wan smile. This was fun. Wish we could go back to California poison water, right? Yeah, I said. Guess so. I stood up and thanked him. I walked out of Noah Oppenheim's office, into the elevator bank, and past its giant chrome rendering of the NBC crest. A peacock that said, NBC is in color now. You can watch it in color. Isn't that amazing? And it was. It truly was. I moved through the cubicles of the Today Show newsroom and up the stairs to the fourth floor, with battery acid in my mouth and red parentheses in my palms where I had pressed nails into skin.
Part 3. Army of Spies. Chapter 29. Fukakta.
Go with God, Oppenheim had said. To New York Magazine, of all places. Only in Manhattan media circles did heaven mean a middlebrow biweekly. But how to go with God when the interviews were locked up on NBC's servers?
I motioned McHugh over to an empty office and told him what had just happened with Oppenheim.
This is why this guy continues to get off, McHugh said. So they were coming up with this argument with Weinstein's lawyers, not telling us, waiting to deliver it like a death nail, he added, mixing metaphors. They were trying to get us to wrap up our reporting. That's why nobody's particularly interested in this recent victim we're talking to.
I looked at him, nodded. So this was the end.
It's a bunch of bullshit, what happened here at this company. It's a big story.
All the reporting, I said wearily. They own everything. He looked at me hard. Come here. Back at our cubicles, McHugh glanced around, leaned to open a desk drawer. Say, he said, fumbling through a stack of AV paraphernalia and producing a silver rectangle, you did have the interviews.
He slid across the desk a USB hard drive with Poison Valley written in black Sharpie on one corner.
Rich, I said.
He shrugged. Backup. I laughed. They're gonna fire you. Let's be honest, neither of us is gonna have a job after this. I moved in like maybe I was gonna hug him and he waved me off. All right, just don't let them bury this. A few minutes later, I was headed for the safe deposit box at the bank, walking quickly. I didn't want to give Oppenheim the chance to reconsider his suggestion that I take the story somewhere else. But whom to call? Looking at my phone, I saw Oletta's email from the previous day. If there was an outlet that knew the challenges of going up against Weinstein, it was The New Yorker. I dialed Oletta. They're not running it with what you have, the recording? He asked. That's ridiculous. He told me he'd make some calls and get back to me. I'd been trying to reach Jonathan since after the meeting with Oppenheim. Call me, I wrote, then, pettily, I'm going through the biggest thing in my life, and you have not been there for me. I'm making critical decisions, and I'm making them without you, which sucks. I step out of shoots for you, you don't reciprocate. When he finally called, he was annoyed. I can't step out of meetings to these explosions of texts from you. It's ridiculous, he said.
I'm just dealing with a lot, I said, and I feel like I'm doing it alone.
You're not alone, so come be with me. You know I can't do that. We're starting a company here, which barely registers for you.
There are weird things happening around me, I said. I feel like I'm going crazy.
We both got off the call in a huff. By then, I was descending into the subterranean vault. I put the hard drive in the deposit box and watched as it slid back into place with a nails-on-chalkboard squeal. The next day, Aletta introduced me to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker. Remnick and I set a time to talk the following week.
It's an issue, he wrote, about which we have some experience.
At 30 Rock, anxiety pulsed through McHugh's and my interactions in the newsroom. Greenberg seemed on edge. McHugh cornered him and expressed incredulity about the conflict of interest argument. He reminded Greenberg that we'd looked at industry connections between Weinstein and my family and determined there wasn't a conflict of interest. Greenberg said vaguely that they'd find a way forward.
So this is not dead at NBC? McHugh asked.
Look, I'm not going to debate this, Greenberg replied.
I'm not debating, McHugh said, but I have to say, for the record, I disagree. When I saw Greenberg, likewise, I had questions.
This conflict of interest thing, I said.
Noah said Harvey told you about it. He found time in between looking panicked to appear sincerely puzzled.
I never talked about that with Harvey, he said.
It was early afternoon when Oppenheim texted, asking to meet.
I spent all day having conversations about this, he snapped as I arrived in his office.
He looked like he hadn't slept.
We all think there's a potential,
and then, evidently off my look of pirouetting optimism, he repeated,
potential solution.
Whoever decided that the story couldn't run had now, it seemed, realized the story couldn't not run either, at least not the way Oppenheim had left it the day before. We're going to have one of the most veteran, senior producers in the company, a Dateline person who's been here 20, 30 years. We're going to assign them to retrace everything you've done, scrub everything.
Who? I said.
Corvo, who's unimpeachable, is going to oversee it. He's picking someone. I thought of Corvo, the Dateline veteran, a company man, but as far as I knew, a principled one.
If this is genuinely an effort born of wanting to run it, then I welcome it.
Vet the hell out of it. The reporting holds up.
It's not just the checking, Oppenheim said. My view is that the tape and Harvey Weinstein grabbing a lady's breasts a couple of years ago, that's not national news.
I started to talk, and he held up a hand.
It's news somewhere. Do it for the Hollywood Reporter. Great. It's news there. For the Today Show, a movie producer grabbing a lady is not news.
He said they wanted more, and I said that was great, too. I could take Gutierrez up on her offer to come in and shoot with Canosa and reshoot with Nestor.
No, 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 he said. We're picking this producer to vet things. Everyone we're considering is on vacation till Monday. Let's just hang tight till then, he said.
Noah, if you want more, I need to be able to go out and get it.
I know, he said. I'm just saying hang tight till Monday.
This is verkackt, McHugh was saying.
Please, Rich, no more Yiddish, and it's verkackte.
It calls into question my credibility, which I fucking...
No, it doesn't, I said. How's that? We have had a trusted producer vetting every element of this. I've been there the whole time.
Oh, sorry,
a chirpy young Today Show producer said, opening the door. We were in a mailroom near the Today Show bullpen. Everything else was full. The producer started sorting through mail and futzing with FedEx forms. We stood awkwardly for a moment.
So, life's good, I managed.
Yeah, she said. Great, you know, sad the summer's over.
Sure, I said.
When the door swung shut behind her, I turned to McHugh.
Rich, I'm not going to let them force you out. But it is forcing me out, McHugh continued under his breath. What the hell is this?
Basically, it's a special prosecutor role, and if they want to shut this thing down, sure, they can, but it's very promising.
Rich looked at me like I was insane.
They said no, then they realized it's a PR scandal, and now they're just going to rope-a-dope us to death till it's March, and we're still talking about this. Basically, we need more, we need more. They're not going to say no to us. It's okay, come in.
Sorry,
the producer squeaked and tiptoed back over to grab some documents she'd left behind. I smiled tightly, then said to McHugh,
don't you think that's a little conspiratorial? Maybe they'll run it.
Bottom line, it's trouble that the president of NBC News is talking directly with Harvey and lying to us about it. He was sulking. What are you going to do about the meeting with Remnick next week? I thought about this. I keep it, and we keep that option waiting in the wings. Potentially propose doing it for both. I don't know. You've got to be careful now, McHugh said, because say it does come out in another publication, and it does look bad for NBC. They could so easily turn on us. Hello, said one of three smiling interns who had just opened the door. Don't mind us. Despite McHugh's skepticism, I was lifted, as I left Rockefeller Plaza and made my way through the harsh neons of Times Square, by newfound optimism. NBC's a bird in the hand. As long as they're letting you keep reporting, stick with them, Jonathan said on the phone from Los Angeles. Noah's in over his head. He's not malicious. My feeling that the obstacles of the last month had been a passing fever dream was reinforced when Thomas McFadden from NBC Security got back in touch to say he had an update. They'd figured out where at least some of the menacing messages came from. It turned out I really did have your run-of-the-mill stalkers with mental health issues. No grand conspiracies, no one lurking outside the apartment, I told myself. Harvey Weinstein's mood was shifting too. In conversations with those around him, he'd once again gone from jubilant claims that his contacts at NBC had promised the story was killed to concern that it hadn't happened cleanly and I might still be working. Weinstein knew Boies was friendly with Lack and asked if the attorney might put in a call to the network head.
I can call Andy and see if he'll tell me, was all Boies would say.
More sources were telling me that they were getting calls from Weinstein or his associates that they found unsettling. Katrina Wolfe, who had gone on camera to say she'd witnessed the London settlement process, nervously told me that she'd gotten a call from a veteran Weinstein producer named Denise Doyle Chambers. Doyle Chambers said that she and another veteran producer, Pam Lubell, were back working for Weinstein, conducting research for a book. A fun book, Lubell would later say, on the old times, the heyday of Miramax. Weinstein had asked them to write down all of the employees they knew and get in touch with them. Later, how much the two women believed this cover story would be a subject of public speculation. Lubell, anyway, seemed to have convinced herself. She even put together a book proposal. On its cover, Bob and Harvey Weinstein smiled in black and white. The graphic above them read, Miramax, those were the days, my friend. I thought they'd never end. But the cover story, threadbare to begin with, quickly frayed. In early August, Weinstein called the two women back into the office.
You know what? We're going to put a hold on the book, he said.
He asked Doyle Chambers and Lubell to call some of your friends from the list and see if they got calls from the press. On the phone with Wolf, Doyle Chambers didn't make much small talk about the good old days before she came to the point. Weinstein wanted to know if Wolf had heard from any reporters, if she'd heard, specifically, from me. And he wanted copies of any emails she'd received or sent. Wolf, rattled, sent my messages to Doyle Chambers and denied she'd ever responded to them. And there was something else. The names Doyle Chambers and Lubell compiled and called were being added to a larger master list. The list was light on insiders from the glory days and heavy on women Weinstein had worked with and troublesome reporters. It was color-coded, some names highlighted in red, indicating urgency, especially among the women. As Doyle Chambers and Lubell updated the list based on their calls, they weren't told that their work was being sent to Black Cube's offices in Tel Aviv and London, then onward to operatives around the world to serve as a basis for their increasingly involved work on Weinstein's behalf. At the same time, John Kassar, an agent I worked with at the Harry Walker speaking agency, was fielding inquiries from a wealth management firm in London. Its representative, Diana Phillip, said that she was planning a gala focused on women's representation in the workplace. She wanted a reporter well-versed in that issue to give a speech, or possibly even several. Kassar had been in the business for a long time and was wise to attempts to fish for information. But Phillip had all her answers lined up. She rattled off the particulars, including the investors who would be in the room. She said that her firm was still finalizing its decision. They'd need to meet with me first.
I hope such a meeting could be arranged sometime in the coming weeks. In fact, I'm planning to be in New York next week, so if Mr. Farrow is available, that might be a good opportunity,
she wrote in an email. It was the first of several messages saying that a meeting had to happen promptly, and eventually, when this failed to gain traction, that she'd settle for a call with me. For more than a month, the emails from Diana Philip kept coming. Kassar figured she was just really, really into investigative reporting.